This is Red Ice Radio, a beacon of sanity from Northern Europe. RedIceCreations.com.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. Anyone from around the world who are interested in the mysterious and the big questions of life, what we consider to be important, who we are, where we come from, where we are going, and what really is going on. I'm Henrik Palmgren, and our website is RedIceCreations.com. We present a lot of different material and research for you to consider and think about. Today we're talking with Linda Moulton Howe. She is an American investigative journalist and documentary producer, writer, director, and editor, currently based in Albuquerque, New Mexico. In addition to television, Linda produces, reports, and edits the Science, Environment, and Earth Mysteries news website, earthfiles.com. Linda also reports monthly science, environmental, and earth mysteries news for Coast to Coast AM and weekly news updates for Dreamland Radio. Linda has written four books, Mysterious Lights and Crop Circles, Glimpses of Other Realities, Volume 1 and 2, and An Alien Harvest. She's also produced two versions of the documentary A Strange Harvest. She joins us to discuss how the mysterious object in the Baltic Sea, Göbekli Tepe in Turkey, and the creation of Homo sapiens all connect together to form an intriguing and vivid picture of humanity's past and other intelligent life. Hi, Linda. Welcome to Red Ice Radio. It's great to have you with us. First of all, thank you for coming on the program. Really nice talking with you today.
Well, thank you. You are in one of my favorite parts of this planet. I love Stockholm and Oslo, and I have traveled around in that part of the world, and I think that you really, truly are in one of the most beautiful, clean areas on Earth.
Now, exactly, we should begin in our backyard here, where we are located up here. We have so many things to discuss today, of course, so many fascinating developments, things that you've covered on earthfiles.com, the excellent resource on all things scientific, environment-related, and anomalies, weird things, mysteries. So with that in mind, when did you first heard about the Baltic Sea ocean find, Linda, and just out through the gates there, kind of what was your take on this very strange thing?
Well, I first heard about it on I think it was June 19th, 2011, about a year ago, that the last day of a treasure hunting expedition that Peter Lindbergh and Dennis Asberg, who are co-owners of the Sweden Ocean Explorer, and they're based in Stockholm, but they were out looking for underground sunken wrecks and treasures, which is what they do for a living. And they have been very coy about letting anyone know where exactly they had their radar aimed. It was blue view and multi-beam sonar, and they saw this very strange object. It was about 100, let's see, I think it was about 100 and some feet below. I'm trying to think, you guys think in terms of
meters, yeah.
Yes, and I think in terms of feet, but they originally said that they were some 60 nautical miles from the nearest land between Sweden and Finland. Well, just in the past week or so, I have heard from a resident in Sweden who says that they now are convinced that where this actually is on the Finland side of the Baltic Sea. So when you talk with them in your interview, you might ask if this is closer now to Finland than it is to Sweden. But going further into what it was, at my news website, earthfiles.com, the most recent interview that I did with Peter Lindbergh was on June 28th, 2012, after I got back from Göbekli Tepe, Turkey, that we're going to talk about. And there was another update that they had gone out yet again. And so I have done two or three interviews with them, and I called Peter and said, can I get an update? And to my surprise, on the phone, he said that the divers this time went down and that one of the most intriguing pieces that they radioed back up or told Peter and Dennis, was that they were looking at, and this was a quote at the time, a fireplace circle of stones on top of the large anomalous object.
Mm-hmm.
Now, let's talk a little bit about both. The large anomalous object that was first reported, it's 275 feet down. That was the number I was trying to find.
That's right.
And that would be about 90 meters, correct?
Something like that, 80, 90 meters, yeah.
Okay, so in the first 2011 reported side scan sonar image, it looks like sort of an illustration of the Millennial Falcon from the TV show, and that's where there was all this popular explosion that a year ago about what in the world is at the bottom of the Baltic Sea between Sweden and Finland, 275 feet down, that looks like a Millennial Falcon. And the one thing you can say, I'm looking at a side scan sonar at earthfiles.com right now, that it has so many 90-degree angles. And when I have worked with other geologists and geophysicists on underwater objects, the one thing that you hear over and over again, nature underwater does not deal with 90-degree angles. So when they see a lot of 90-degree angles on objects under the water, it always is a red flag. Is this artificially structured? Well, then, in this last interview with Peter, he says if you go essentially to the curved front of what looks like the Millennial Falcon, and in other images, I have shown that there is a second object off of the side scan sonar, sort of off to the upper right. If you are looking down on this object, there is a second odd object that has what looks like two arches. It's off that angle. It's off the curved end of the, we'll call it the Millennial Falcon-looking large object, and kind of on a straight line toward the second object, which is some distance away with these double arches, that the divers told Peter and Dennis that they were looking at a circle of stones like a fireplace outside. So when I finally received one of the photos, allegedly of this ring of stones, I had been expecting to see something that would be tightly packed and larger. This is about 3 feet across, so it's very small, and it's loose. It's a loose gathering of stones in a somewhat circular pattern. So is it something that nature could have done, or is there really the suggestion of some kind of, I don't know if habitation is too strong a word, but that something occurred on top of this large Millennial Falcon-looking structure a long time ago in which fire had been burned? This is a question that Peter Lundgren, he posed this to me and said, if that were true, then this must be, the big object, must be something from before the last ice age. Now suddenly the story becomes almost mind-boggling, because the last ice age reached its maximum 18,000 years ago, and then about 12,000 years ago when Göbekli Tepe was being structured, everything warmed up. It's a complicated story that we'll talk about more. But if you go back 18,000 years and earlier, that part of the world, of the Baltic Sea, was in ice. So if there is a large structure about 275 feet down sitting on the bottom of the Baltic Sea now that might have a circle of stones on it, was it on dry land before this last ice age or during at some point when the water in the Baltic Sea was 300 feet lower than it is now?
Right.
It's an average all over the planet that during the ice age, the last ice age, that sea level was 300 feet lower because all that water was trapped up in ice. And this is a very intriguing question, and I think that Peter Lundgren is very puzzled. Nobody has proof yet of anything. But are we dealing with an object that was literally on dry land 18,000 and more years ago?
It's absolutely fascinating. It's going to be very interesting to see what else is coming out about this. At this stage, obviously, the only thing that would solve the mystery a little bit more is simply more data. And I know that Peter Lindberg and Dennis Åsberg were going to head off for a third expedition, I believe. Either they've already come back from that or they're going to do it. I'm a little bit uncertain. I'm going to ask Peter about that. But hopefully at that stage, I know that they're going to take samples. I know that they were going to try to get a 3D scan, if you will, of the object as well. And hopefully, Linda, that will actually reveal a little bit more about what we're actually witnessing here. Because at this stage, I mean, if we begin to speculate, what are some of the plausible items here that we might be looking at? As you said, if we have a separate object or a site, a fireplace, if you will, on top of the actual object, but that could be, as you said, that could be something that was put there later, basically.
Yes, and so we need a timeline verification if it's possible. And I think adding to the question is the divers on that last dive before, they told me they were going to go out July 20th. So we are speaking on August 2nd, and both of us need to find out, did they go yet? And if so, what did they find? But in that last dive, the divers took a photograph, and I have it at earthfiles.com. It's a large colored diagram, and it looks all the world like some kind of a meringue topping on a pie. That's what they called it, in fact. Mm-hmm. And it is round, spherical, and smooth, just exactly as you would imagine that something like a pie that would have a meringue on it. Now, when I did the interview, he said that, quote, this June 2012 large color image was taken by a diver of what he said looked like solidified meringue at the same spot on the surface of the larger object. That's the Millennial Falcon one. And you can look, once you get this guidance, you can then look at the 2011 images in the water, and you can see this little round piece that matches this close-up of this meringue. And he said, the meringue is about 27 feet in diameter and about 5 feet at the highest point. And then there is a thin white arc behind this round, spherical, smooth object in this photo. And he said, the thin white arc is the downline rope so the divers can find their way back to the boat, close quote. Well, the very fact that they were able to get this close, get this, I think it's a very fine photograph considering the murkiness of the Baltic Sea.
Yeah, exactly, that's right.
And that when you go in Earth Files, I found exactly that 27-foot diameter. We'll call it, it looks like a round drop on top of the Millennial Falcon object, and I did an arrow, so everybody can see this. And you begin realizing whatever the heck this thing is, it is large, it has detail, and when Peter and I talked about what are the divers, what are they getting as kind of human mind interaction with these objects that they were swimming around, what do they think? And he said, well, you know, we're beginning to wonder if we are looking at something like a cement structure.
Yeah.
Well, if something were a cement structure, doesn't that automatically jump it in a timeline on Earth to the last century or so? And then, could it possibly be related to war, like World War II, or is something that was a construction for either military or bridge or something like that? But once your mind starts going in that direction, you then have to say, well, how in the world would a 197-foot diameter cement structure with all these 90-degree angles and these odd details on it get 297 feet down in the Baltic Sea?
Yeah. It's, I mean, if they've, if it's made on land first or and then transported with a big barge or a boat out there to be dropped, I mean, this is a huge endeavor. I'm surprised that there is no data about what, you know, from government sources, basically, if so, if that was the case, you know?
Well, to me, as an investigative reporter and TV producer, I think one of the most interesting parts of this whole story is how absolutely quiet the Swedish government, the Finnish government, yeah, the German government, the U.S. government, the English. I don't think there has been one comment from any so-called political authority when this is a large object, almost 300 feet deep in the Baltic Sea. You would think that governments would come forward and say, we would like to examine this.
Yeah, the silence might be telling. It could be something intended to cover up. I know that there's people speculating that it might actually in some weird kind of way be related to the MS Estonia that went down. And of course, the government was very reluctant to be part in trying to salvage the ship for unknown reasons, actually. And they wanted to cover it up, actually, with a kind of a sarcophagus. But I think that this is not big enough, after all, to cover the whole ship. So it's. I think that's out for me. I've ruled that out at this stage, but I don't know.
Yeah, same. When I did Coast, and there was a caller who called in and said they were convinced that this was related to the Estonia mystery of the sunken ship and all those deaths, and that it was related to some government plot. When you just go to the basic facts of sizes, there's incompatibility between what's down there and the Estonia event.
Absolutely. That was in 91, by the way, for those who don't know, and there is a little story there related to it about the fact that there could have been some foul play. There's several people that have looked into that, and that's a possibility. But at this stage, as you said, Linda, I think it's just, that's too, it's too big for being that. Sure, something that could have fallen off. But let's, even if we follow through on that line of thinking, it would be a massive effort to get this shape, I think, by, I don't know, pouring concrete down there or trying to work with this underwater. It just doesn't make sense.
I know. And clearly, we need now to know the details that Peter and Dennis have if they did go out on July. Let me just look at that date again. They told me at the end of my interview, July 20th, we plan a third expedition with, again, both Blue View sonar and multi-beam sonar attached to the boat. And they, Peter was explaining that it takes special data processing to assemble all the images and make sense of them, which can take a great deal of time, and that they were still working with the June images in July, but that his goal, especially, he wanted so much to produce what he said would be a clear three-dimensional image of the whole large Millennial Falcon-type object, and perhaps a 3D image of that second smaller object that has those two arches some distance away. And I think he's right. If they could actually have really good, clear sonar in 3D of both of these objects, it might start going a long way towards saying, okay, it's not this, maybe it's this. And then how can the divers with some kind of cameras that can actually get wide images, can the divers get down and take better images? Maybe the Baltic Sea is just too murky for that. I don't know.
I think so. I believe you're right, because obviously the further away they are from the object to get the whole object into in the lens scope, so to speak, I mean, then you would lose the view. You had to have incredible powerful lighting or something like that to be able to light it up properly. But even at that stage, I think it would be really difficult. That's why I believe as you say, Linda, a proper scan, basically, of the object, turning it into 3D or something like that would reveal what it actually is, because it seems to have some kind of, well, mushroom shape, for the lack of a better description, right?
This is what Peter brought up in the June interview with me, that they had found at the bottom, the divers. Remember, this was the first time that they had diver interaction with this object, even if the divers can only see little bits and can only take photos in close-up because of the murkiness of the Baltic seawater. But at least they had human minds and eyes interacting down there for the first time. And Peter said that the divers are saying, and I think there was something in the sonar that seemed to reinforce this, that there was a structure like the neck of a mushroom at the bottom of this Millennial Falcon object. Again, reinforcing some kind of artificial structure.
Absolutely. We have a few different interesting anomalies, like the small little about 10 inches in diameter hole. And I don't know where that's located. Is that middle of the object, Linda?
This, at earthfiles.com, if you scroll down, I've got a section, small hole in large circular object, and it has a good photograph of what the divers took. And here's what Peter Lindbergh told me, quote, "The divers were going down to take a sample loose from the surface of the large circular object. We moved the downline to a shallower end of the circle, and we sent an ROV, that would be their remotely controlled vehicle, down to look where we had the downline. And that's when the ROV saw a hole, videotaped a few seconds, and we backed off to avoid making visibility murky, because when these machines are down there in the divers, they've got this constant double-edged problem. Their movement makes the water cloudy. So how do you approach and take photographs in water that is constantly becoming murky from motion?"
Yeah.
Now, the divers tried to find the hole again, but then the water was too murky. They did get this one photo. So in those 8 to 10 seconds, they've got video, and he said the diameter of this hole to them and to the divers appears to be approximately 10 inches. That's small. And he said, "And we're not certain where the hole is because we don't really know where the downline came down." Again, these guys are fighting one of the murkiest seas apparently on the planet, that the Baltic Sea is notorious for being so muddy, so murky, so dark.
That's right. They have algae blooming there and during the summer, and it's been, I think it's partially because of all the, you have the farms around in around the Baltic countries there as well, and it's just been heavily environmentally really in a bad situation basically in the last few years. They've tried to clean it up. In any regard, there seems to be a window as well, obviously, because last they were there in 2011. Then during the winter, they didn't do any dives. So now it could just simply be because it's too cold. It's too they can't operate. I mean, usually it doesn't freeze. That's rare. I mean, you have to go up to the very very further up north of it to get the freezing. But now 2012, summertime, spring, they're returning back. The window seems to be maybe closing then again. Do you think, Linda, that they'll be able to pull out data, or will we have to? Is it a cliffhanger? Will we have to wait maybe to 2013 until we actually get a real, proper data out from this?
Well, I can tell you that Peter Lundberg and Dennis Asberg are going to be extremely dejected and disappointed if their goal of this July mission doesn't come up with enough images to produce 3D, at least 3D clear of the large object. That was what they wanted to most accomplish now in 2012. If they have to wait yet another year for the weather, they may be worrying that they're not going to have enough money to do anything, because the hope was that if they could keep finding stuff, that maybe there would be people who would keep coming forward to help them do these expensive dives and the ship and all of that. So I understand the difficult situation that they are in, and you're going to talk with Peter tomorrow?
That's right.
Okay. Well, I need to follow up with him as well. Maybe what you could do, I would appreciate this. Could you send me just a summary paragraph of the highlights of what you learned from him tomorrow, and then I'll decide whether if they found something to go forward, then it would be worth trying to do another coast update. If they haven't found anything more or can't do the 3D, then we're going to have to wait.
Absolutely. We'll keep you posted on the details about this, Linda, and we'll forward what is known, if there's anything new that has been coming out, and we can see how to proceed with that, definitely. Now, oh boy, it's just a very strange thing. And I know that Dennis, he made a YouTube, a little video a while back as well. He tried to explain some of the situations, that it's taking time, and they have a tremendous pressure on them as well from curious people, from the public, from media, and they're battling this left, right, and center right now. So I understand that there's a lot of pressure there, of course. But one of the things that I want to talk a little bit about as well is one of the anomalies, one of the big ones, is the issue with the gear, basically. The team seem to have been experiencing strange shutting down of their electronics, disrupting cameras. What possibly are we looking at here?
Well, I asked Peter about that as well. He said that they had gear that was functioning just fine in the days before the last June mission, and we don't know what's happened in July. And he said when they would get down close, or what they were trying to do, that they would have static. And I said, is it possible that there is something that is being given off by the large millennial falcon-looking object that is interfering with the magnetic fields? And he said that they've asked themselves that. Could this big object be giving off something that they haven't detected yet with an instrument, but that it is interfering with their sonar equipment? And I think that that is very interesting. And I know that that issue also came up when they were trying to get a sonar picture of the smaller object off in the distance. They thought that they had, in 2011, that they had interference when they were trying to get an image on that second sort of double-arched object. If either one of these objects are giving off anything that would interfere with sonar, what could it be?
Indeed. I mean, I'm going to ask you to speculate a little bit here now and give us one, or if there's more, several things that you believe that it is at this point, even if that means, okay, nothing at all. It might turn out to be natural. There's many things speaking against that right now, but religious site, is it again related to something like we've seen in Göbekli Tepe? Could it be off world? Could it be something that actually has landed and consequently been covered up or crash landed here? What's your wildest guess here?
Well, until they get analysis, which is exactly what Peter and Dennis had hoped at the July dive, that they would get the 3D, they would get samples. Because if it is not metallic, then how in the world could it be something from outer space? I mean, yeah. I can't imagine something of a concrete meringue reaching here from outer space. But then again, none of us know for certain what does get here from outer space. And the idea of an artificial structure that is made out of some sort of concrete or cement that throws back into the question of wartime, we still are at a size that even if it were some construction that people forgot about of something in one of the bridges or around the Baltic Sea in Finland and Sweden and so forth, wouldn't somebody have had a record of some huge structure that fell from some highway construction or something else? It's the complete and total silence from the world surrounding Peter Lindbergh and Dennis Asberg about what this could be. If they have had anyone talking to them off the record, they haven't said so, which would be a good question for him tomorrow.
Exactly. I'm going to ask him more about this, because it seems, now I know that they've been reluctant to obviously reveal their location of this because they don't want to have other people go in there. At the same time, I heard Dennis say that if you do find something, apparently you're obligated, I guess, by law, some merchant law or maritime law or something like that, you have to reveal your find, apparently. So we'll see if and if they have said anything to authorities, to Swedish government or something like that, and if they then consequently have commented upon this, because at some stage if this continues, if this carries on, I guess they would have to want to investigate. They would have to do something, at least not for because of public pressure, because it's been in the mainstream papers here. So it's certainly been getting around. It was even, we had a headline, it was a couple of weeks ago now, about this being some kind of anti-submarine from, you know, blocking the Nazi subs that were going up into the Baltic. Now, this also is a theory that doesn't hold much water, actually. Linda, have you heard about this one?
A little, and again, it would have to have been metallic, correct?
I think that this is actually the weight, the reasoning here is that this, it's kind of a metal mesh that is basically the blocker. It blocks both radar, sonar, and actually can catch, if you will, the actual submarine in its net, if you will. And one of the ideas is then they have these concrete weights that they put to hold the mesh on, basically, and that could possibly explain the drag marks, if you will, as well. But the fact is, it's just way too big. Those that are known are much, much, much smaller. Those kind of weights, the concrete things that they've done for the mesh. Yeah.
Well, another important point that both of us need to clarify now, if possible, if the information that came to me the past few days is correct, and this might even be in Finland territory, what are the laws there versus Sweden, and what are the boundaries coming out from the land geographic borders of Finland into the water and Sweden into the water? Where do each of those countries define the border of their territory out in the Baltic Sea?
Yeah, that's a good question. Something for me to look into as well. I'm going to try to clarify that, because I think there is a little part of it, I think, actually is on international waters, and that might be where it actually is. But again, I'm not certain. I shouldn't speak ahead of myself here. So I'll ask Peter about that and try to clarify that. Now, is there anything, obviously there's so many things to discuss here, but is there anything else that you feel is important to talk about when it comes to the find or this object or something you'd like to maybe see what you would, how the chronology for you would play out for a good to get some more of our questions answered, basically, Linda?
Well, what intrigues me, and I think it intrigues Peter, is that if you do go back in time into the ice ages and the sea levels on average go down 300 feet and you are now down where this object is, was this something of a dry structure on dry land? And if so, you're pushing the timeline for this structure back a long, long way, thousands and thousands of years. Now we're into this huge story that I am grappling with now in all of my work, that the timeline of history as it has been taught to us for at least a few centuries is that Sumeria, Mesopotamia, modern-day Iran, Iraq, Syria, that this was the beginning of so-called Homo sapiens civilization, writing numbers and so forth, 5,000 years ago. Göbekli Tepe in Turkey already has more than doubled that, and we are talking about a structure where I was in June. I was there physically on June 13, 2012. That the carbon dating that Klaus Schmidt has done over the last, since 1994, carefully and meticulously, nobody's doubting his work, is saying that those tall, 19-foot, elegant, thin, sculptured, three-dimensional sculptures on the T-shaped pillars means that some mind, some intelligence, conceived this 30 acres of these tall pillars placed carefully in repeating circles, and that somebody had the ability to perceive in their mind's eye that they wanted a three-dimensional cat-like animal on one, that they wanted a scorpion and birds and very other odd objects on another, and that the more I stood on one of the like a kind of deck path now that you can kind of walk around above the dig, and it makes it convenient because you can see and photograph, and you're staring at these beautiful. There's something about them that's haunting these pillars. They are elegant, and yet they are so eerie, and they are inaccessible to understanding. That's what hit me as sunrise came on that morning of June 13th, and I was there for the first time with the sun at my back and looking down into the four basic archaeological dig structures that are in this one huge pit that Clauschmidt has been working on since 1994. And your mind is trying to grasp, as any human mind does, what was this made for? And nothing hits you. Nothing comes into your mind intuitively. And the more that you look at these pillars, that you knew that somebody, somehow, something, some intelligence had the ability to create 19-foot tall limestone beautiful pillars with three-dimensional animals coming out of them, that means you had to have not only the ability to perceive the whole hillside with what you wanted over 30 acres of all these repeating rings, but you had to have the ability with some unknown technology to create a 19-foot tall limestone pillar with a huge three-dimensional animal coming out of it, meaning nobody glued the animals on to these pillars. These pillars were conceived and created as one massive, elegant piece. And the more you stare and the less you comprehend, the eerier it gets. And then how does this tie in to the whole issue of before ice ages, during ice ages, and after ice ages?
Yeah.
If the object nearly 300 feet down in the Baltic Sea that we were just talking about was there before the ice age and then, or during the ice age, let's put it that way, at some point during the ice age when the sea level was 300 feet lower than it is today. What happened in southern Turkey, 6 miles from what we call the Syrian northern border today, that an intelligence would pick out this hill northeast of San Lurfa and decide that this huge complex of repeating circles, in your mind's eye, just think of circle after circle after circle, maybe 280 of these pillars in circles covering 30 acres on an extremely remote hilltop. There is no civilization there. And making it even more baffling, Klaus Schmidt, in all of these years since 1994 to 2012, he has never found one piece of evidence that this hilltop ever had habitation. There are no pots, cooking pots, fires, urns. There's nothing. They have not even found tools that could explain how these huge three-dimensional animals, if you want to say this, growing out of the elegant tall pillars, how was that even accomplished? Now, making this even more incredible and possibly tied into what was happening in the Baltic Sea and many other parts of the world, Klaus Schmidt realized as he was going deeper and deeper and deeper around the pillars that he's been able to expose so far, and please keep in mind, you and your audience, only 5% of the huge archaeological site has been exposed.
Yeah, it's amazing.
And as he's digging, and he's finding not only pillars, he's finding extraordinary totems and statues, which we can talk about. But right now, I want you to keep your mind's eye thinking about going down in hill dirt. And as he went down in the dirt, as an experienced archaeologist, doing carbon dating as he went, finding that these pillars had to have been put up 12,000 years ago, but that there was something extremely strange about the soil composition, what's called compression. I've used lots of soil compression tests in my work on animal mutilations. And what you find is, in the animal mutilations, you go to a site, you go to a biophysicist who knows soil compression, and they automatically will give you data back that says this 2,000-pound animal was dropped from 150 feet onto the ground, and here the compression physics shows. Take that same physics, go to Göbekli Tepe in southern Turkey, and you have hard physical evidence that those pillars all over this hill that were constructed by something unknown with an unknown technology, let's say, 12,000 years ago, someone somehow decided about 1,000 years later, 10 centuries after the construction of the pillars, to cover the entire hilltop of all of those circles of pillars back over with soil. Now, I have talked about this with Robert Schock. I have interviewed scientists at the University of Arizona that started publishing a couple of years ago their hypothesis of what happened in North America approximately 11,000 years ago, same time period. If Göbekli Tepe is 12,000 years old and it got covered back over 11,000 years ago, 1,000 years later, we are now at approximately the same moment in the timeline that the University of Arizona scientists have been studying what's called the Younger Dryas black mat that is in a layer, the same layer, over almost half of the United States. Grasp that. That if you go down a certain depth in the United States, in certain areas, you come to carbon. It is a carbon layer. It's called a black mat. And inside of that carbon layer, wherever they find it, they find also nano diamonds.
Yeah.
Nano diamonds can only be created in one way: high heat on instantaneous impact of something coming in and interacting with the soil of the earth. Now, the hypothesis is that the ice age was ending 12,000 years ago. Sudden warming. We're talking about major sudden warming. There had to have been ice melt all over the areas where there were ice glaciers. And that was 12,000 years ago by almost everybody's estimate. That's when Göbekli Tepe was first constructed. Then, for reasons that have been totally mysterious and baffling to scientists, 1,000 years later, it was a refreeze. The temperatures plunged all over the Northern Hemisphere, at least. But the signs of the greatest disturbance, actual huge violence, is on the North American side, Canada and the United States. And this is where they find this black mat with the nanodiamonds, and the University of Arizona scientists that have published now twice about this. Their hypothesis is, they keep refining it, they think it could have been a combination now of meteorites and comets. You would have ice and rock suddenly coming in at huge screaming velocities into the northern hemisphere angle of this planet, exploding some in the atmosphere and causing fire in the sky, literally, and some hitting the ground. And these impact zones all over so much of North America would be where they find this black mat called the Younger Dryas. And not only do they find thousands of these nano diamonds, but they find iridium.
Yes.
Iridium, for a very long time, like in the Chicxulub crater in the Yucatan that they think was responsible for the extinction of dinosaurs 65 million years ago, that this huge asteroid, having to be at least a half a mile diameter, hit, and there's a crater, it's called the Chicxulub crater in the Yucatan, and that this would have been responsible for that extinction. Well, if you have let's say, 1,000 pieces of ice and stone that are all coming in to the North American side at essentially the same time because of some big thing happening in the solar system, and you got fire in the sky, you've got impacts on the ground, tremendous heat, nanodiamonds are being created, carbon is being created by fire, and iridium is in all of the black mat known as the Younger Dryas era. Iridium, like Chicxulub, is only linked to impactors from outer space because of the rarity of iridium. Iridium has only been linked by scientists to, we'll call them objects from outer space.
Yeah.
So now you begin, in your mind's eye, think of the Earth, see North America like from a satellite. You have all of these objects that are suddenly coming in. The sky is on fire, things are hitting the ground, and what happened to animals? 33 large mammals went extinct 11,000 years ago. There were saber-toothed tigers, many skeletons. I've interviewed scientists about this fact. Saber-toothed tigers, huge, were found with their spines twisted 180 degrees, as if they were suddenly, the big cats were suddenly either plucked up by something that was spinning. Something caused their spines to literally be twisted 180 degrees, and their fossils have been found with 180-degree twists in the spine. The mastodon, the big mastodon, one of the other animals that went extinct, they have been found clearly fast frozen in tundra with buttercups. These are little delicate yellow flowers that are so perfectly preserved in their mouth. They were eating buttercups when this unbelievable violence from, let's say, above just overwhelmed them, and they were quick frozen. So what would suck all the heat out of the atmosphere, just like quick freezing vegetables? That's another big question.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if all this were happening on the North American side of the planet, what was happening on the Mediterranean European side, your side?
Yeah.
This is very interesting because there is some work that in southern Turkey that they have also found carbon layers. The problem is, I don't know if there's been any success in matching the timeline. If North America was 11,000 years ago, which seems to be the consensus, was the fiery mat in Turkey at the same time or not? So there is at least indications that something huge happened, at least in the northern hemisphere of this entire Earth. And what on the Turkey side would have had foreknowledge, anticipation that something violent was going to occur on this Earth, and they wanted to preserve Göbekli Tepe, and the only way to do it was to cover it completely up with soil?
So
it's
absolutely fascinating. Now, just to clarify that point, it's actually after then this theorized, or I mean, we have evidence, as you say, of the major global catastrophe here. It's before this that Göbekli Tepe actually is covered up.
Well, yes, because just take these two numbers. 12,000 years ago, the pillars covering 30 acres, at least 280, maybe 300 of these pillars were erected by someone, something, some intelligence. Move in forward into the future in time, 10 centuries, 1,000 years into the future, and that entire Göbekli Tepe hilltop gets covered up. And when you are 10 centuries into the future, that is the same time period on North American side that the University of Arizona scientists are hypothesizing that all these pieces of asteroid and comets hit on the North American side, creating the black mat of nanodiamonds and iridium, and called the Younger Dryas era, and there was a gigantic plunge in the temperature of the entire Earth that they call a refreeze of what was global warming for those 1,000 years that Göbekli Tepe had been exposed. Who and how did they cover up all of those 30 acres as if in anticipation of what may have happened on the North American side that would affect the Northern Hemisphere? That is the hypothesis now hanging out there.
Absolutely fascinating. In a little bit here, we're going to take a short break before we return with more, but there's a few little things we should talk about before that. Basically, what this could be, I mean, we have from the mythological record, if you will, evidence of catastrophe, something which seems to allude to some kind of, I don't know, incoming planetary body. Are we talking about the exploding planet hypothesis of Tom Van Flandern? There's a number of different theories here, but one of the more interesting takes on this as well is that it seems also, Linda, that it's after this point that, at least the way we know it today, that civilization, so to speak, is kind of kick-started, if you will.
Yes, that's a very, very good point. For academics, a line was drawn in the sand over the last few centuries that there was nothing intelligent on Earth prior to 5,000 years ago in Mesopotamia. That is clearly not true. Göbekli Tepe is upending all of that.
Yep.
So now we're more than doubling the old academic line in the sand. We're at 12,000 years. Who was, and I'm going to pose it the way I'm thinking about it, who was here on Earth terraforming? Terraforming is what we hope to do on Mars sometime in this century. Terraforming is when an intelligence has the ability and the technology to mine, create dams, deal with water, plant crops, harvest genes. All of this, I think, was occurring on this planet for millennia, perhaps millions of years, as one government agent told me. Linda, we're dealing with advanced intelligences from this cosmos that have been terraforming and have bases on this planet for more than 270 million years. Now try to wrap your mind around that. If that is true, and if the government document that I was shown in 1983 is correct, and it said, this is a literal quote, extraterrestrial biological entities have been manipulating DNA in already evolving primates to create Homo sapien. That the Latin term Homo sapien was in the government document. That means that modern Cro-Magnon Homo sapien would be somebody else's constructed smart android. And what about Neanderthals? And going back to all the models to Homo erectus. Well, if advanced intelligence, more than one type, uses this planet and millions of planets throughout the, we'll call it this universe, as Michio Kaku would say, that there are advanced civilizations 1, 2, 3, 4, and he puts us on Earth at zero. That we're so out of it, we're so new, we're so complete, we've been sold such a bill of goods. We're not alone in the universe, never have been alone in the universe, and that the truth about our planet in all of its strange history is because there have been geopolitical territorial conflicts among advanced intelligences that use this planet for its resources, ranging from genetic material to metals in the soil to creating, and this is a fascinating part, creating stone structures in circles, pyramids, and ziggurats that can interact with frequencies in order to create energy and communication. Now, once you are there, once you've been exposed to this kind of information coming from government and military sources, you can't go to a place like Göbekli Tepe without thinking, as Robert Schock, the PhD geologist from Boston University who led us there, he said, it feels like I'm looking at tuning forks. It is as if this entire hilltop, when it was constructed originally, was used to interact with frequencies. Well, now suddenly, the mind begins to think about the hypogeum in Malta. This is another huge Earth mystery. The hypogeum in Malta, was the construction date is somewhere back around 8,000 to 9,000 years ago, if you're not aware. There is a room called the hypogeum, and they have been doing studies in that. It's all underground. It's all sculpted in limestone underground, complex, incredibly beautiful, incredibly refined, refined like the pillars above on the hill in Göbekli Tepe, but completely different. It's totally underground. And there is one room, the hypogeum, where they have taken instruments and they have taken people, and they have found that if you are at 105 to 110, especially, but as high as 115 hertz, and that's the signature usually of an adult male voice, that voice of anyone standing in this specific smaller room called the hypogeum, speaking in a normal talking sound volume, will be heard throughout the entire underground limestone structure. Why would anything have been constructed that long ago to accomplish that? And when you start adding up how many sites on this planet, including the recent work that was published about Stonehenge just in the last few months, there have been people studying the possible resonance that Stonehenge, on top of all of its astronomical work, that it also was built to resonate with certain frequencies. Who was here 12,000 and more years ago that used frequencies perhaps to construct in stone?
Fascinating, Linda. We're going to take a short break here at this point and return with more of these mysteries, of course, and continue our conversation. I'm going to ask you a little bit about the find, if you will, large underground pyramid in Alaska. Fascinating stuff. This is just hot off the press almost here. We'll talk about that and much more here when we come back. But again, then, if you want to hear, you know, find out more about these stories, basically, of course, check out the excellent website earthfiles.com. With Linda Moulton-Howe, because it's just so many things. It's too much going on right now to pin it down, of course, in these short 2 hours. But Linda does an excellent job over there, so do head on over there and check it out. Now, stay with us, Linda. We'll take a short break, and we'll be back with more after this. If there's anything else, by the way, you want to mention about your website, go ahead and do so now.
Well, I would urge all of your listeners to please go to www.earthfiles.com. There are 2,000 and some reports in chronological order from 1999 to 2012 and counting that include 40-some thousand images, documents, and illustrations. And I wanted a site that would be news-focused and always evolving chronologically so that you could find anything ever just by going to the archives in Science, Environment, and Real X-Files and finding anything by date and by subject. And on top of that, I have done this six-part series on Göbekli Tepe, the trip I took in June. And on the headline page, there is a hot link to each of the six parts. And when we come back after the break, what I would really like to do is to talk with you and your listeners about the unbelievably weird, eerie stone totem and statue that was found in that hilltop along with the tall, elegant pillars of Göbekli Tepe that has left me with the weirdest feeling about that hilltop and ties directly into the government document that I was shown that extraterrestrial biological entities manipulated DNA in already evolving primates to create Homo sapiens.
Excellent, Linda. Earthfiles.com, that's the website. We'll talk more about this when we return, so stay with us. In our second hour available in our member section, Linda describes in detail the eerie stone totem depicting an image of a mysterious animal-like being found on the hilltop of Göbekli Tepe and the human infant that is coming out of it. Then she explains how Göbekli Tepe ties in to the last ice age. She describes how civilization may have been kick-started after this major catastrophe. We also discuss the so-called plasma squatterman hypothesis and the effects of trauma being imprinted on the psyche of humanity some 12,000 years ago. Linda speaks about animal mutilations, genetic manipulation, and the possibility of an alien intelligence reconstituting life on Earth if humanity destroys itself or if something out of our control happens. She says we are at the crossroads. Later we discuss our relationship to our creator or creators and what might happen if they return. We end the hour talking about the giant underground pyramid found in Alaska, of all places. Stay with us if you want to hear more. At redicecreations.com, you can log in if you're a member to stream or download this continuation. You can also access our program through RSS feed with iTunes or our iPhone app. That also works for Android phones, by the way. If you're not yet a member but want to get full access to our archives and watch our films, videos, or listen to any of our previous programs in their entirety, simply click on subscribe to find out more on how to acquire a member's pass. It's quick and easy. If you follow our instructions, you'll get instant access. Lots of gems for you in the archives on all kinds of interesting and fascinating topics, so don't miss it. Next on Red Ice Radio, we have Peter Lindberg from the Ocean X team in Sweden to discuss the latest on the mysterious object in the Baltic Sea. After this, Rosa Corey, Daniel Pinchbeck, Jan Irvin, William Dean A. Garner, Mark Grant, Walter Burian, Joel Gilbert, Ron Keller, Randall Carlson, Charles Upton, Chris Knowles, and many more. But right now, coming up next, Hour 2 with Linda Moulton Howe. Stay with us, don't miss it.